Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Markets Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle, joined today by news editor Emma Powell. How are you doing, Emma?
Very well, thank you.
Excellent. And Julia Forshaw, how are you?
Good, thanks, John.
Excellent. So both of you have been enjoying the World Cup, I assume, unlike us English folk.
Good match last night. Well, yeah. No, bad match.
Yeah, not
bad
so good match.
Yeah,
being football, a Canadian, I can sit on the outside.
Football's not coming home.
It's there, not, as it
there,
turns out.
There you go. Never mind. Never mind. We got close. Like the Welsh a few years back.
In the Euros, yeah. That was very good.
We share the pain now. It's been a mad week, an absolutely mad week in politics, on the markets, in the company news section. I mean, Trump's here. Everyone's gone mad. The cabinet has sort of fallen apart a little bit, back together. I haven't even looked at the white papers today. Have you looked at it at all?
I haven't, no.
No, but are we leaving the European Union? Are we leaving it in all but name? Are we leaving it not at all and only in name? Who knows? We're not here to talk about that. We're going to talk about the news this week and the cover feature. So cover feature is Income Majors. It's about the biggest dividend-paying companies on the stock market, and we're running the rule over them to see whether their dividend-paying capability is likely to continue. Julia, you've covered the two big fag companies.
That's right. Imperial Brands was on it last year, but British American Tobacco is a new entry this year.
Yeah, I always thought that was a big dividend payer. I'm just surprised that it's a new entry.
It was always good, but it was this purchase of Reynolds America, one of the biggest M&A deals in history and the biggest in the tobacco sector ever, that was the catalyst that bumped it into Income Majors.
So the sheer scale of its dividend has changed.
That's right. The sheer scale of the company as a whole. It's just, massive increase.
Okay.
In everything from profits to earnings per share.
Yeah, we'll come on to the detail of that in a second. And Emma, you're going to be talking about the two banks that are in the list, which is HSBC Lloyds. And Lloyds is, was Lloyds in it last year?
No, it wasn't.
Yeah, it wouldn't
it
have been,
wasn't,
would it?
No, but now it's because if you account for kind of share buybacks and special dividends, it's now quite a sizable yield.
Indeed, chunky. We'll come on to Income Majors in a second. Let's talk through the two lead news stories. One I think is a company that investors, our readership, is likely to be probably a little bit more interested in than the other, but we'll start with the one that I think is a little bit more esoteric and a little bit less likely for kind of your average man on the street to be invested in, but it's important nevertheless. TP ICAP.
Yes.
Big profit warning this week.
Massive profit warning. Well, I think part of the reason the shares fell about a third in one day, and actually the warning is that EPS will just be slight for this year and next year. It's just going to be slightly below the guided range. But I think the reason the shares fell so much is because faith in management, I think, has been destroyed a bit. Basically, what happened was John Fazakerley, he's been sacked and replaced by the global broking, head of global broking. He came out to market, I think it was last year, and said he was going to be able to get £100 million annualised synergies from, obviously, what was Tullett Prebon's acquisition of ICAP's voice broking business. Mm-hmm. Turns out he can't, they can't. And they've had to revise that down to £75 million. And obviously, the board just felt that he couldn't carry on leading the company after he had upgraded to market. And obviously, it turned out that they just can't get the costs out of that deal.
I mean, it's quite interesting. I look at companies like this and, you know, maybe it's that I don't do enough homework into them, but I find them really difficult to get to grips with. And,
this kind of
explains why even the management can't really see what's going on. If they're promising one thing and not able to deliver it, difficult businesses to manage, difficult businesses to invest in.
Yeah, it is. They are difficult businesses to understand. I'd put Nex as like the most similar, which obviously was ICAP, as the most similar business. Yeah, I mean, TPI cap, so it's quite a high-yielding stock, and the dividend looks quite well covered still. But yeah, they're basically inter-dealer brokers. They're brokering deals between two, or trades between two sides that might not know each other and therefore trust each other.
Institutional.
Yeah, exactly.
Well,
that's what they do. And they've got like a commodities business, and global broking is the biggest bit in data analytics. But yeah, they are, compared to just, you know, a bank or an asset manager, they are difficult companies to understand.
Are they likely to be hit by Brexit? I mean, I noticed when in the piece that they talk about Brexit preparations being a bit of a financial burden.
But well, nobody, and they said as much. John Fazakerley, as was then chief executive, said at the last results, we've got some operations in Europe, but basically we don't really know what's happening. Like, nobody does. We don't really know what's happening. So we're trying to come up with a contingency plan. I think what's happened is actually they were concentrating so much, my understanding is, so much on trying to get the costs out of this deal, they basically kind of dropped the ball on investing in other parts of the business and also on those kinds of preparations. MiFID 2 as well. There's been a lot of regulatory change, which MiFID 2 haven't been concentrating on.
Well, that's been a nightmare for everybody.
Yeah, exactly. But Brexit is another big one. And I think the upshot of this, I would say, is I think there's going to be more warnings.
From them or from the sector?
Well, potentially from the sector, but I think from them, because obviously we've got this new guy in now, and I can just imagine that the costs will be revised up. I mean, the kind of cuts to earnings forecasts go out to, I think it was about 18% cut out to about 2020 by kind of analyst consensus forecasts. So I think people are thinking that now you've got a new chief exec in, he's going to be looking at things a lot differently and maybe pointing out, okay, costs are going to be higher here. We need to. They've announced some investment in their businesses. They're quite low growth. These TPI cap certainly. You know, very low revenue growth. So I can imagine there may be more kind of warnings to come.
Mm, okay. Well, I'll carry on avoiding that sector. Yeah, then. Julia, let's talk. I mean, this is a management story as well. Slightly different type of management story. This is one of those board disputes that we see every now and then. Stobart's Group.
That's right. Lots going on behind the scenes.
And I think, you know, this is a company investors might actually own, because it was essentially a spin-off of the Eddie Stobart Logistics.
That's right.
Group. Yeah. And so people know it very well.
Yeah. And you probably know London South End Airport too. No, it's something that's quite familiar.
Know exactly what it does. Might have flown through it.
Part of it anyway. It also has a big energy business too. But yeah. Kind of what investors would know probably most obviously would be the airport.
So there's kind of two stories here. One is the business itself, which we think is doing very nicely, and you tipped it a few
yeah, a couple of months ago.
And the other side is this management upheaval, this turmoil, which kind of is sort of it's really overshadowing the massive progress this business is making.
It is. The fundamentals of the business are still doing extremely well. But behind the scenes, former chief executive and the founder of Stobart Group, actually, as well, Andrew Tinkler, has been campaigning to have the chairman, Ian Ferguson, removed from his position. And he was wanting to have him replaced with this retail entrepreneur called Philip Day.
Okay.
And finally, after lots of back and forth and lots of angry tweets and letters sent to shareholders, they had their AGM on Friday last week, but the result didn't actually come out until Saturday evening, because it was such a close result that they had to recount it a few times.
Oh my goodness.
But yeah, and so as a result, Ian Ferguson has been re-elected, but with 51.2% of shareholder support.
So there's like another close vote that we maybe had to think of.
But kind of in a twist of events, Andrew Tinkler, he was a former chief executive, but has most recently been a director at the company. He stepped down and was replaced by Warwick Brady. But he was fired last month for a breach of contract and fiduciary duty, because he was sending these letters to shareholders, which the board thought was out of line. And so normally he would have been up for re-election as a director, but since he got fired, that got taken off the schedule.
So this sounds personal.
At the AGM, some shareholders on the floor put forward that he should be re-elected as a director, and he received 51.4% of support, so just marginally ahead of the votes that Ian Ferguson received.
So he's back on the board then?
No, because then the board was just like, no, I don't think so. We just fired the guy. Like, you can't then re-elect him again. So they struck it down. But so now Mr. Tinkler is pursuing legal action against them.
Okay, this is a convoluted, personal, acrimonious thing. Why is it happening? Because the business seems to be doing okay. I mean, it really is. They just don't like each other.
Yeah, this has all kind of come into the public in the last couple of months, kind of the next last 2 or 3 months. But when I was speaking to a representative for Mr. Tinkler, he says that this all has kind of stemmed back to about a year ago, when Stobart Group was looking at potentially buying the airline Flybe. And they had thought this was quite a good idea. They'd put together this funding vehicle, thought it was great. And Mr. Tinkler apparently disagreed with it, didn't think they should make the acquisition, didn't feel comfortable with the funding they were putting forward. And that deal eventually fell through.
But you cover Flybe as well.
Yes.
So did he have a point? I mean, that has...
Flybe isn't one of our favourites.
No,
so
it's on a cell, isn't it?
A mini cell, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, Flybe do use... I mean, they fly out of Southend Airport.
That's right. So they were kind of thinking this would make sense because they're already based there. And Stobart Group obviously owns Southend Airport.
And they do have a sort of close working relationship. So Stobart Air Logistics will provide some of the kind of operational aspects of Flybe's operation. So there is crossover.
Yeah, it's worth a discussion. But at the same time, yeah, we're not particularly big fans of Flybe. So... there could be arguments made either way.
But. Yeah, okay. And so this comes down to a disagreement over strategy, essentially.
Essentially, yeah. And because the board itself, that's kind of not the line that they're taking. What they're saying is that Mr. Tinkler is an excellent entrepreneur. He was great at kind of taking this small company, building it up to what it is today. And now they need someone in the role who can really generate operating profit. And perhaps Mr. Tinkler isn't the right person for that.
Okay. I mean, if you look at this company, however, I mean, it's a reasonably chunky company, but it is still at quite an early stage when you look at it, the potential growth is there. I mean, look at Southend Airport.
That's right. Still lots of growth opportunity to come from there.
Tiny little airport, lots of land around it, not that many airlines flying out of it. I mean, I think you've got Flybe and EasyJet and recently Ryanair.
Yeah, Ryanair is the most recent one to come in.
So, I mean, lots more they could do with it. So, I mean, perhaps you still want someone who's entrepreneurial there.
Perhaps you do.
But I mean, what is it that we like about the shares? I mean, are we looking for an entrepreneurial growth profile, or do we think it's at that cusp of turning to something a bit more, you know, kind of blue chippy, as it were?
Yeah, I think we still think that there's just huge growth opportunity to go. And in all the recent updates, the fundamentals are still there. They're still on track to meet their two main goals, which is to have 5 million passengers a year through Southend Airport by 2022, and having supplying around 3 million tons of renewable energy by the same year.
Mm.
And so that's all completely on track. They offer decent yield. Shares aren't looking too expensive. They've been quite volatile lately with the quite a bit on the Ryanair deal announcement, and then down quite a bit as the kind of management board fighting.
What are we saying? Buy on the dip. Buy on the dips, then.
Yeah, absolutely. Buy on the dip.
Use them as a
great company. It's a shame what's going on behind the scenes, but the fundamentals are still there.
Yeah, I like it. I like it as a customer as well. I dread the prospect of 5 million customers going through there. I loved it. It was empty.
Yeah, I've flown through it once before, and it is delightfully small. It's so quick to get through.
Yes, Stansted used to be like that. Look at it now. Now I have to go to Southend instead, and it'll become the same eventually. Never mind. Okay, let's move on from the news. Let's talk income majors. As I said, we do this. Well, we first did it last year. The idea was we do lots of things about the FTSE 350, generally looking at sectors by sectors. We do the AIM 100. We look at the biggest companies on the AIM, biggest companies on the smaller company market on AIM. But we don't really do anything that looks in detail at the very biggest companies on the stock market. And most people buy these companies, these very very large companies, for the income they offer. So we're talking the Shells and BPs and the banks and the cigarette companies and telcos. It's quite a useful exercise. I think this is a really important feature because so many of our readers depend on this income in retirement. Should we start with the banks? Let's start with the banks. How is life for the banks? And not all the banks make this list. Barclays doesn't, notably.
No.
RBS hasn't yet returned to the dividend list. Standard Chartered...
has, but just. And it's meagre, to say the least.
But we've got HSBC. Let's start with them. I mean, this has been a solid income paying company.
Yeah, so HSBC was the only bank actually to make it in last year when we started this feature. Yeah, I mean it's the only bank, you know, even when the financial crisis hit, that it cut its dividend, but it didn't go away with its dividend, and it hasn't. It's kept paying at its rate, which I think is 51 cents a share since 2009. I would say, you know, these companies are amongst the risky end of this feature series because, you know, for example, HSBC had to take massive loan impairments because it has big commodities exposure. Luckily, didn't have to cut the dividend. But I think what is part of the reason they are so risky compared to maybe other companies is the fact that returns have basically just been so hard to come by at the moment. So, you know, where you might have companies that are backed by very steady earning streams, that's not the banks.
Yeah, I mean, there's an interesting graph here, which I'd not seen before, actually. I think this is fascinating, that essentially the dividend tracks the forecast return on equity.
Yeah, which is returns on equity for all sorts of reasons. You know, you were looking at early 20s percentages prior to the financial crisis. Obviously, we know that was basically achieved by taking risk that is now just not deemed acceptable. Now you're looking, I mean, I think HSBC have got a target of about 10%. When interest rates got cut in 2016, they had to remove that timetable. Now they're just saying medium term returns on equity of 10%. Pretty pathetic if you look historically, but given rates are so low and the fact that they've got to hold a lot more capital on the balance sheets, it's just harder and harder to achieve decent returns on equity. And it's very volatile as well, you know. Like, part of the reason I mentioned the lack of steady earnings backing the dividend, that's because, yeah, you know, you have loan impairments, restructuring charges, misconduct charges. I mean, the list of one-offs throughout the past decade has just been billions and billions of dollars.
But some of that, I mean, the misconduct charges have got,
they're lessening.
They're in the past. I mean, they're not gone entirely, but yeah, the bulk of that is in the past. Does it really matter that, you know, we're in a kind of low returns environment, given that the company is yielding 5.5%, the shares are yielding 5.5%? You know, should we just get used to this kind of sort of low returns environment and take what we can? Or are there risks that actually it might get worse in the future?
It's difficult to say. I mean, I actually would say the banks, the big banks, are in the best position they've been in from a capital position. And potentially, actually, from a returns on equity generating position than they have been for the past decade, I think, definitely. And like you say, I guess the new normal is low interest rates, isn't it? I definitely think, I mean, with the banks, basically what you're looking at is, what are their CET1 ratios and are they on target? Are they enough? Because that will basically determine whether you're going to get, whether the dividend is going to get cut. Is the CET1 ratio stable enough? Is it growing? And actually, in HSBC's case, and also Lloyd's, it is, and it's ahead of target. I think it's about 14% target that HSBC have. They're ahead of that. That's basically, you know, we've seen during the past decade, pre-tax profits have gone up and down and up and down, and they are very volatile. They've managed to keep the dividend, paying out, you know, a nice dividend, basically because they've managed to grow their CET1 ratio.
And some big share buybacks as well.
And some big share buybacks, which are expected, actually. And it was interesting. They did a $2 billion one earlier this year, they announced. That's probably going to be the only one, though, actually, this year. And the shares did fall on that, which I thought was a bit overdone, to be honest.
Well, people expected more.
But people just expect, yeah, they expect more than one share buyback. But that was another point, actually. HSBC, John Flint, the new CEO, said, we're going to now just be investing a bit more in the company to try and kickstart growth.
Yeah, I mean, you know, some of the things that would have hurt it in recent years, you say exposure, you know, bad loan exposure.
Yeah, they had a lot of toxic loans from...
But some of the areas it had exposure to that were behind that, you know, oil and gas extraction, particularly in North America, have improved with the oil price recently.
Yeah,
the prospects there look okay.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that was just a risk point. I was saying, you know, there is, you know, dividend coverage is quite thin compared to some other companies. But yeah, you just look at the capital ratios and.
And they're a
that
buy.
Is improving.
And they're a buy.
They Pretty are cool. a buy.
Let's quickly touch on Lloyd's. Very different business. HSBC much more of a global bank. Lloyd's
very much
a UK lender.
Yeah, the complete opposite. So Lloyd's didn't make it in last year, actually. But they are literally the opposite end to HSBC. HSBC is, you know, the only universal bank left now. Lloyd's, very low risk. You know, quite a boring... Well, as boring as a big bank can be, but kind of vanilla.
Boring.
Vanilla. Kind of, they basically concentrate on UK retail banking. So you'd think, hang on, it's going to be really hard for them to make decent returns on equity, they actually have upgraded, last year upgraded their capital generation guidance. I think what Lloyds has done really well in comparison to Barclays and also RBS is they kind of got themselves back on track a lot sooner, despite obviously, you know, taking advantage of the government's bailout, managed to really just shrink their business, simplify it, took a lot of the one-offs. Okay, yeah, they still have been incurring quite hefty kind of PPI charges, but that should be behind it next year because the deadline's been set from the FCA there. And yeah, I think it was it 2014 when they came back with that 0.75p dividend, and it's just been growing ever since. And management said they're going to do, rather than kind of special dividends, which they've done past few years, they're going to be doing share buybacks. So,
and the government's stake is
completely gone now.
Completely
so gone. They're completely private again. And again, they very well capitalized bank. Always has been, actually, for the past few years, has always been one of the most well capitalized.
Who's in charge now? Is it still Antonio Horta Azzaro? Still. Wow. So that might explain some of the strong performance of this bank.
Well, exactly. Yeah. I mean, he's been there for a long time now, I think.
He came in after the crunch.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I remember he came in and he had to take time off.
I mean, that's not surprising, but yeah.
But he's back. He's come back. You don't hear about it much anymore.
Well, no, but I mean, and he's clearly good.
I'd say that's good.
Yeah, he's clearly a good chief exec because you compare, I mean, obviously there's lots of historic problems with RBS, but you compare like RBS, Barclays and Lloyds, and Lloyds is just the top.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah. Okay, that's a buy too then.
Yeah, that's been quite a long-standing buy tip actually.
Yeah, it's still, the share price is still a bit wonky.
It kind of bobs around between kind of 60 and 70p, but it is... That is an income buy.
Yeah, one's half the long term.
Yeah, 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 definitely.
Excellent. Thank you, Emma. Should we turn to tobacco? Or rather, not so much tobacco these days.
It's still tobacco now. It's still, for both British American Tobacco and Imperial brands, the sales from tobacco make up the vast majority of group sales.
Yep.
But it's slowly changing. Every year they're selling fewer and fewer cigarettes and more what they call next generation products, kind of the best known of which would be those vaporizer.
Yeah, which around London you see everybody using now.
Yeah, very true.
So fewer people smoking actual cigarettes than vapes. But I don't know if that's not true of the world as a whole.
No, but in developed markets it seems to be.
Yeah, definitely going that way.
That's right.
So I mean, let's talk about these two companies. British American Tobacco, as you mentioned earlier, has really had a game-changing acquisition this year. Reynolds, which is a big American tobacco company.
That's right, yeah. £41.8 billion deal. So, yeah, it's fundamentally changed the business.
Yeah, such was the scale of this deal that it kind of messed the numbers up for a bit. We really...
Yeah, the last set of results, when you compare it to the last year's, it just looks completely wonky, but for good reason.
Yeah, I mean, tobacco is a dying product. Certainly, in as you say, developed markets... Are the emerging market? I mean, the emerging markets, from when I cover this company, particularly British American Tobacco, emerging markets were the big thing. It was still people buying cigarettes in Malaysia and Indonesia that were the big driver of this business. Is that still the case?
It is, but probably not to the same extent that you would be thinking about it from years past. There's still growth opportunities there, but I mean, it doesn't seem to be as much of a focus as it was before. The big focus now for future growth and just current CapEx is how to develop these next generation products, how to kind of get into these new markets and make a product that people actually want to use instead of a traditional cigarette.
So what sort of, we'll talk about both companies because I know that they're both investing heavily. What sort of scale are these NGP next generation businesses so far in terms of the overall business of British American and Imperial?
Yeah, for both of them, at the moment, they represent kind of low to mid single digits of proportion of sales each year. So they're still very, very, very small. But like for British American Tobacco, for example, they're thinking that they by kind of like 2030-ish, so still quite a ways off, but they will probably be representing closer to like a third of sales by that point.
Okay. So tobacco is still very important.
Still very important, yeah. And every year they're selling fewer and fewer traditional cigarettes, but...
I mean, I kind of look at this and I think of our own industry, you know, publishing, because obviously, you know, once upon a time, before the internet, everyone bought magazines, and what a wonderful world it was to be a journalist. And then, of course, the internet came along, and the game was, well, you know, we'll switch our business models to the internet, and it's essentially moving one thing into another channel. But it didn't really happen like that.
No, I mean,
are we going to see the same sort of levels of disruption in this industry here? And on that basis, is this dividend really safe?
Yeah, I mean, the whole argument just boils down to, are consumers going to want to use these new next generation products? Because this whole, you know, health crazed new millennial generation aren't smoking cigarettes, but will they want to instead have tobacco through or nicotine through inhaling a vaporizer instead?
Yeah.
And I mean, so if that plan does pan out, then the dividend probably is safe. But
it seems slightly. I mean, this, okay. So I was kind of thinking out loud here. People who smoke vaping or use vaping products are people who used to smoke cigarettes, who are trying to give up smoking cigarettes, and here is an alternative. If you've never smoked a cigarette, and a lot of younger people haven't, why would you start smoking a vape?
I don't know. Does it look cool?
No. Not right now. I think the technology would have to... I mean, it looks like you've got some kind of mouth organ or something. You know? Ridiculous, these things. But I don't know. I mean, these are the questions I would be asking of these kind of businesses.
I mean, it's arguably healthier because a lot of these health organizations have said that it's the burnt parts of the cigarette that are the bit that's really bad for you. And I guess the nicotine itself is what's addictive. It's not those smoke particles.
Yeah.
So arguably, it could very well get a new generation addicted to a new product.
Wow. What a great business model this is.
Yeah, we're not here to be the moral police on these vice stocks. But.
I mean, I was actually surprised when I read the Imperial write-up that they're actually looking at something that falls into the NGP category, which is not necessarily what you would think. The cannabinoids market.
That's right. They just bought a stake in this company called Oxford Cannabinoid Technologies, and they basically research medical marijuana and potential uses for it.
I mean, this is potentially a huge industry.
It is, yeah. It's becoming more and more legalized across the world. Canada, where I'm from, recently legalized.
What you lot are like. So.
And yeah, so that's another, perhaps more controversial than a traditional vaporizer, but yeah, another market that they could potentially be exploring as well.
But Canada has moved beyond the medicinal usage into recreational.
Yeah.
Legalizing recreational
usage. Much to the dismay of many there.
Yeah, well, yeah, I can imagine. The same would happen here if it was tried. I mean, there are debates happening. And there was obviously a very big case recently where a young child needed cannabis-based medicine and couldn't get it, and it's led to a number of debates in Parliament. But I could see this. I see this.
Yeah,
I get
the medical vape uses
thing.
For it.
The vape thing, I'm not convinced about, but the medicinal side, this makes sense. I think.
I mean, it would be much easier to argue, you know, if they have solid medical uses behind it and it's now legal, then yeah, there's a huge potential market there. Whereas vaporizers, it's just a question of will people get addicted to these like they did, like past generations did to cigarettes? Because it's still nicotine and it's still addictive, and if anything, it might be an even more efficient way of delivery. So
yeah, I mean, we've got this company on a buy, and I mean, I look at the share price there, and it's actually a little bit different looking to British American, which has been a kind of steady downward trajectory for the last 12 months. We've had a bit of a bounce here at Imperial.
Yeah, it's coming up a little bit now.
What's behind that?
I think, well, for the case with British American Tobacco, it's a bit more, especially after this Reynolds deal now, it's a bit more exposed to the US, and the US, the regulator, the FDA, is looking at limiting how much nicotine can be in traditional cigarettes.
Mm-hmm.
And so because they're so much more exposed to that market than Imperial Brands is, I think that's why that share price has come off so much this year, especially because they just made a huge deal increasing their exposure to there.
Yeah.
Whereas Imperial Brands has kind of made a bit of a bounce. And at the last set of results, the chief executive, Alison Cooper, was kind of... She couldn't really give any details, but she was saying they're kind of looking at overhauling the portfolio and selling off some of these underperforming brands of different... She was saying products, but I think it would be reasonable to assume that she's thinking traditional cigarettes, because they've been quite vocal about saying that the future is in next generation products. So they're kind of making quite big strides already to overhaul their portfolio to sort of start to get rid of these underperforming assets and use that money to partially pay down some debt and partially invest this in innovation in NGPs.
Who's a potential buyer then of those assets? I mean, is it another of the big tobacco companies? There aren't that many of them left, are there?
Yeah, she was pretty tight-lipped about the whole thing and wouldn't say if she lined up any buyers, but this was just something that they were looking at and hoping to achieve in the next couple of years to kind of free up some money.
Okay.
But yeah, potentially some of the other big tobacco organizations. British American Tobacco hasn't said anything about being an interested buyer, but you never know what's going on behind the scenes.
Okay, so we're still buyers of Imperial. And
yes, it's a buy tip.
And Bats?
Yeah, Imperial Brands is a buy tip, and Bats is a mini buy. Mainly just, they obviously still offer great income, but we're just a bit more bearish on that exposure to the US until the FTA actually comes out with a solid decision.
Okay, when do we expect to hear something on that?
Probably sometime in the next, I want to say before the end of this year, but it's kind of hard to say.
Ah, slow moving world of regulation.
That's right.
There you go. Thank you very much. Thank you, Julia. Okay, there's 10 companies that we look at in that feature, as I say. So we've got the two banks, we've got the two cigarette companies, we look at the two big oil majors, and who else we got? We've got Vodafone, Glaxo,
National Grid,
which is the only utility that makes it these days. It's a slightly different beast. What else have we got in the magazine? We have John Rosier's diary. This week he's basically talking about some shares that have gone wrong and how he has responded to those. Sector focus this week is on silver, if I remember rightly. Lots in the results section, including results from Mercado, which sent the shares wildly down and then wildly up in the same day, such is the ease of which we can understand that company and its prospects. We obviously discussed that on last week's podcast. What else we got? All the usual personal finance and funds content, which they will be talking about on their podcast tomorrow. Lots of comment. Simon Thompson, Bearball, The Trader and Chris Dillo, as per usual. And there's a little bit more in the news section, including an update on the incredibly complicated Disney, Fox, Comcast, Sky merger battle. I understand that one even less than I understand TP/ICAP at the moment. It's
very difficult to understand.
It's very convoluted. Megan's put some interesting diagrams together here, which
should help
to explain it a little bit. That may come to an end at some point. It's been a long-running saga. But if you've been a Sky shareholder, you've done extremely well out of it. There you go. Anyway, thank you for listening. Thank you again, Emma. Thank you, Julia. Pick up the magazine at all good newsagents, Income Majors, the prospects for Britain's top dividend shares. And we'll be back again next week. Thank you.
Hey, Drew Scott here. And I'm Jonathan Scott, reminding you that life's better with a home policy from American Family Insurance. They can help you get just the right protection at just the right price and help you save when you bundle home and auto. Kind of like Goldilocks and the Three Bears. It'll be just right for you. We love a custom build. American Family Insurance. Insure carefully. Dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.